Thanks to Larry Flaxman for joining us last hour. His co-author, Marie Jones, is here with us the rest of the evening to talk about their new book, Viral Mythology. You know, a heck of a lot of the stories, biblical stories, biblical characters end up very similar stories told in other cultures in their mythology. We'll get into that and a lot more coming up right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Marie Jones, in the book Viral Mythology, there's a story you discuss called the hundredth monkey effect. Tell the story.
This is another theory whereby an idea can hop from one region to another. It comes from a study that was done with monkeys that were learning how to, I believe, clean fruit. And there was a certain way that they were doing it that was rather unique on this particular island. And, you know, all of a sudden, monkeys on another island started doing it. And then on another island, it just sort of spread. So the question was, how? You know, did one monkey from one island call another and say, hey, guys, we've got a much better way of doing this. You know, try this. Was it a genetic glitch that just happened to occur at the same time? Did they get that idea out of the collective, out of that cloud, out of the grid at the same time? There's jumping Jesus phenomenon.
Explain that one.
Discovery. These are different, really the 100th monkey theory, but different names. The idea that something can all of a sudden just spread like crazy without there being a physical or visible, I should say, connection. The Jesus, the jumping Jesus one, was just kind of a joke. It was a humorous idea that Robert Anton Wilson came up with. It came out of one of his lectures in the 1980s, and he had this idea of using the term Jesus as a measurement that was the sum of known scientific knowledge starting from the year one common era. And so to jump at one Jesus, it would take our species between 40,000 and 100,000 years. But what he noticed, or what he claimed, is that as time went on, the Jesus jumps became shorter and shorter, and yet the amount of information and fact was doubling. So it was exponentially snowballing, but Jesus was jumping much shorter and yet conveying more information. Tipping points, these are all parts of the different theories that we looked at for how information can spread. Tipping points, that was a huge phrase a few years ago, Malcolm Gladwell's best-selling book, the idea that when enough people get hooked on an idea, it suddenly tips and it goes completely global or completely viral.
Well, back to Jesus for a moment. You discuss elsewhere in the book, later in the book, you talk about the Jesus model. And I don't want to cast aspersions on anyone's religion, but the point gets made that there's a lot of stuff in the Bible that's taken as gospel, literally as gospel by Christians, of course. And
right. It
pops up in other cultures, same kind of character.
It does. And yeah, and again, when Larry and I were writing this, we were real sensitive to the fact that, you know, this might make some people mad, but we're not making this stuff up. The Jesus model, the Jesus mythology, and that's not to say that he did not exist. That's not what we're saying at all. But the mythology behind who he is was also present with many other figures throughout history, including Buddha, who was born of a virgin Maya, queen of heaven, and Horus, the son of Osiris, was born of a virgin called Isis Mary, also on December 25th. Mithras, the sun god of Persia. There are all these different deities that we have had over time, and many of them that preceded Jesus, that had the same mythological motifs present in their story. Jesus also has the hero's journey motif in his story, of basically who he was as a person and what he accomplished. So did many of these other deities. So the cross was a symbol that was not just used in Christianity. It showed up everywhere. So again, we're not trying to insult any religion or say this didn't happen. It's just really, to us, fascinating to know that the persona existed in so many other traditions all over the globe, and even hundreds and thousands of years before Christ himself walked the earth.
Well, you take it even further than that. And again, not to insult anyone, but you could draw comparisons between the Jesus, Buddha, Moses, and some modern heroes, modern superheroes, Luke Skywalker, Frodo, and Lord of the Rings, Indiana Jones. Talk about that a little bit, how that works.
Oh, this is my favorite part of the book. This is what really got us hooked. We're both big fans of Joseph Campbell, who's a comparative mythologist, and he talked a lot about the archetypal symbols and motifs that are found throughout mythology, and how even today, as we're creating our own mythology, he referred to Star Wars as the mythology of today, you see those same motifs. So the Buddha, Jesus, Osiris, Moses, these were all heroes that went on a particular journey that had very particular steps to it. It's called the hero's journey. It's been labeled this more recently. And a lot of writers today, a lot of screenwriters, a lot of novelists, a lot of directors and filmmakers understand the power that that hero's journey has to us today, whether through storytelling or motion pictures or television shows. So it shows up over and over again. Those end up being the biggest box office hits. Those end up being the most universal hits in terms of movies and TV series. We could even look at something like The Walking Dead, and you've got the hero's journey, some of those characters that are going through the same process. So it's just a really powerful motif. Campbell called it a monomyth.
I saw the last Superman movie. I don't know why I sat through it, but well, it's certainly, I don't know if they did it on purpose or not to make him a Christ-like figure, but you know, he comes from the sky to save humanity, and stoic figure who undergoes all kinds of terrible pain and challenges. If they hadn't named him Clark Kent, he could have been Jesus Christ.
Well, you know what's funny is I've written screenplays, and they teach classes in this monomyth. They teach classes in the hero's journey structure. And again, Star Wars is probably the biggest, most widely known example of a modern-day hero's journey story, if you look at what Luke Skywalker went through. But yeah, this is something that is actually taught now to writers as a wonderful way to really grab people on a subconscious level, because we get the archetypes, we get the symbolism, we understand that journey on a more inherent level, and it works whether it's science fiction or drama or even comedy. And if you go back in time, and all of the myths, they're going through this hero's journey. So if it worked then, obviously it's going to work now, or at least Hollywood seems to think so.
As we mentioned, the book traces communication, language, things of that sort, from the earliest grunts through cave art and things of that sort. And then things really kick into gear with the Sumerians. And you cover that in the book about how they develop a written language, cuneiforms and writing, and that really changes everything. These guys not only developed a written language, then they developed written numerals, and that give it a basis, a way to compute and do math. And man, it just seems like that they were tapped into something themselves to have a lot of stuff change in one place.
I think more than anything, the history of the Sumerians and what they did at the time that they did it. I mean, we're talking, 3,500 years before Christ walked the earth. It probably lends the most credence to the ancient alien or ancient astronaut theory, because we suddenly leapt from a point where we were very crude in our means of expression to all of a sudden phonetic representations of sound, very sophisticated alphabet systems, writing systems, which came about after that, symbolic glyphs that had double meanings and all sorts of things that just sort of exploded onto the scene. And there are people that will say, hey, we need to stop selling ourselves short and blaming it on the aliens, because it is possible for humans to have huge leaps in understanding and huge leaps in development and even consciousness. We see it all the time. But this was so shocking, it was so abrupt, that more than anything has lent to the idea that we did get a little bit of help from our friends from above.
Well, you know, go back to the cave art for a moment. You got these drawings at places like Altamira of what looks like bison. And we look at that and say, oh, there's early man drawing pictures of bison. And then you might see something in a different cave that looks like an alien or somebody wearing a space helmet.
Yeah.
Well, they must have been symbolic. That couldn't be, you know, it can't be them describing what they actually saw.
Well, why not, though? I mean, if they're drawing, again, go back to little kids. When I was little, I drew horses all the time because I loved horses. Now, if they're drawing bison because bison are important to them, obviously, for their clothing, for their food, the alien imagery or what looks to us as aliens, why do we automatically assume that they're just making that up? Could that not also be a representation of something those people actually were seeing and interacting with?
Well, I'm with you. I'm preaching to the choir, I guess, but I'm with you on that. I'm just expressing what has been said, I'm sure, to you and to others who delve
absolutely.
Into this stuff.
And it's hard to argue with people because what they will say to you, and they're absolutely right, is that we don't know because there's no proof. We weren't there. So we are interpreting the imagery and symbols of people that we may not even understand what their motivation was.
That's
the big argument that we get.
There's so many big gaps. There's so many gaps that we just don't know. We think we know, but we don't.
Right. And there's a lot of imagery throughout history and a lot of stories, a lot of references to entities that aren't from here. I mean, whether you're looking at glyphs or pictures or images that look like somebody's wearing a helmet with a hose coming out of it, you know, like a spaceman or some type of aircraft, or you're reading about these things in Bible stories or other religious texts or myths or fairy tales or what have you, you know, why does that stuff keep coming up? Is it just that each generation is picking up on the ideas of the last one and continuing to spread it down the line?
I'm thinking of this image, and I can't remember exactly what it was called, but it's from Central America. It's I don't know if it's Aztec maybe, or but it's a guy, like a priest, sitting on what looks like a souped-up motorcycle or spacecraft of some kind, and it's a machine. It's a machine, and I'm trying to think, how do you possibly explain this one away? Is this guy sitting on? It's not, what is it, a rock, a horse? It certainly is not. It looks like machinery.
Right, and there's a lot of images of what appear to be aircraft or even zeppelins and all kinds of things that obviously were not around. Well, at least we think they weren't around 5,000-6,000 years ago. But it's a really tough thing to prove because even today, we do have things like science fiction. We do have fantasy. We draw pictures of things that don't exist, or at least we don't think
sure.
they do. Monsters and creatures and beings. And we imagine what futuristic cars and planes and things will look like. But at the same time, a lot of that is still based on the existing knowledge that we have to form a base of, a foundation from. So were they doing the same? And here's the thing. A lot of our communication, a lot of our information is meant to inform, but a lot of it's meant to entertain. And so now we also have to go look back at everything they did and try to decide, is this image entertainment or is this information? And that throws a whole other wrench into the game.
Sure. Well, what about Nazca lines? Who are they drawn for? Maybe that's entertainment, but who was supposed to see it? And
exactly.
the other gigantic figures that seem designed to be seen from the sky, who was that made for?
Right.
What's your take on it?
You know, today we build churches and we put up big giant crosses at the top of hills or what have you, depending on what your religion is. We have monuments. We erect statues to football players that come from our town or historical figures, Martin Luther King. We erect these big giant monuments to Abraham Lincoln. Were they doing the same thing? Was that their way of showing reverence to something that they had interacted with, something that was a part of their reality? One thing that I did read about the Nazca lines is that there is a way to view them. I think there's a vantage point from some hills nearby or what have you. But regardless of whether you could, you know, somebody stood on a hill and said, hey, Joe, no, carve that, you know, carve out the rocks that way and kick out the dirt this way. Why would they do something that big, that time consuming, that sophisticated, really? I mean, I can't go outside and do something like that without a lot of help. What was the reason? Could it have been the same reason why we do that today? Reverence for something or someone that they interacted with.
Let me ask you this. As you look back across the eons, and you look at ups and downs of human inspiration and ideas, do you see clusters of, we talked about the Sumerians developing written language and then numerals and stuff, and I'm just wondering if it comes in batches like that. You have the Beatles all coming from Liverpool, seemingly tapped into something. Do you have
right.
clusters where people in families,
creativity.
People not necessarily in the same family, all get these ideas at the same time just because of their environment or their proximity to each other?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And again, like you said, we see that in our everyday lives with creative ideas that pop up at the same time. I imagine that for ancient and primitive humans, ideas happened, they evolved in the same way. Everybody was evolving at a pretty fairly similar rate of physical evolution. So maybe there is something to be said for that genetic aspect. Or if you've got a species that evolving along a certain trajectory, as they get smarter, stronger, faster, you know, more evolved mentally and emotionally, certain ideas are going to come to everybody all at once. My favorite theory, personally, is that stuff is out there. And as a writer, because I also write fiction, I can tell you that there are times that I come up with an idea that I think is totally original, and then I find out 25 other of my writing friends have come up with a similar idea.
Right.
And it's like, wait a second, I didn't tell you about this. Is that a part of our evolution of our imaginations? Maybe they have their own evolutionary rate. So yeah, I mean, there's, again, evidence for all these different theories as to why that happens. My favorite, and I know Larry's too, we really lean towards this idea that the stuff is out there. We tap into it in clusters, we tap into it in groups, and we tap into different ideas at different times in a sort of collective sense.
Let me ask you about a specific sort of myth, legend, archetype. I don't remember if you cover it specifically in the book. I know you mention it here and there. Giants. You know, there's some really interesting archaeological evidence that pops up now and then that maybe there really were giants. What's your take?
Yeah, the Nephilim and the giants that, I was going to say the word bred, that had intercourse with human women and developed this, you know, whole new line of humans. Yeah, I mean, is it possible that physically we were once a lot bigger? Maybe giants in terms of, you know, today's standard, maybe they were 7 feet tall. But, you know, back then, if your average person was maybe 5'4", that's going to be very, very tall. Giants, angels, floods, you know, certain deities that seem to show up again and again. Again, there's those motifs that are repeated over and over. But I know, you know, people that have done a lot of research into giant figures that show up in the Old Testament, in the stories of Genesis, that were a part of our actual genetic makeup, that again, bred with human women. I mean, it's sort of one of those things like Bigfoot that won't go away. So is that part of our history? I would probably lean towards asking anthropologists, you know, were there freaky giant people 7-8 feet tall thousands of years ago that today, by today's standards, we would just call them basketball players. But back then, people really looked upon them as being freaks, as being giants.
Marie Jones, co-author of Viral Mythology. We have much more to come with her. Maybe we'll ask about the theories of Jacques Vallée and whether elves and pixies that we reported in previous times and eras are today's modern aliens. Much more to come on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Marie Jones about the new book she co-wrote with Larry Flaxman called Viral Mythology. You know, we still got some of this kind of same stuff going on now. Memes, how they spread. I get a feeling that some of the stuff that spreads online through the internet is created by some of those three-letter agencies just to see how the information spreads. We'll get into that and a lot more when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. One of our listeners, Jeff, sent me a note that I wanted to share with you. He was talking about, he said Bob Dylan once said in an interview that he doesn't write his songs. They're just up there in a stream somewhere, and he's pulling them down and singing them. And then later in another interview with Willie Nelson, the reporter asked a similar question, and he told him what Dylan had said about downloading this stuff. And Willie joked he's the one that he's down, that Dylan is downstream of it. I guess both of those guys are probably tapped into something. Makes you wonder what it is, and makes you wish that we could all tap into it all the time, as they seemingly do. I have to ask you, Marie, what are the Dogon tapped into? Share with us, for those listeners who don't know about this tribe in Africa, tell us about who they are, what their beliefs are, and where in the heck did they get these ideas?
Wow. Yeah, they're a West African tribe that seems to have a very, you know, primitive tribe that seemed to have a real amazing understanding of quantum physics, astronomy, you know, types of scientific knowledge that they shouldn't have access to. And there's been a number of books written about the Dogon and some of the symbolism and their art and their imagery and how it looks like it parallels everything from the evolution of a single cell, you know, splitting and reproducing, to the position of planets or the quantum, virtual quantum particles. Oh, gosh, what else?
Well, I mean, they are an isolated tribe.
They're isolated. They're primitive. They're not tied in with the internet or computers. I think there's even under a million Dogon alive today. But somehow their worldview, their cosmology is so sophisticated, even though the way they describe it probably sounds very fantastical, very, you know, full of imagery, and yet the people that have studied them, studied what their worldview is, they're fascinated. The Blackfoot Indians, similar thing. People have talked about their cosmology and worldview as being unbelievably advanced for an Indian tribe, a Native American tribe.
The Dogon have flat out said it comes from the stars, right?
That they... Yeah, I think the Star Sirius. They have a lot of imagery, a lot of stories, a lot of mythology, and a lot of their traditional beliefs are surround the idea that they are connected into the star, the Sirius star, and that they got they get an extraterrestrial help. They get knowledge. They get wisdom, and they've done drawings. They've showed where the star is, and how do they know this? How do they know where in the Milky Way to even, you know, draw these stars? Yeah, it's just amazing. I love, there's books written by Laird Scranton, I'm sure you've had him on the show before, that just blew my mind, because I had no idea who the Dogon were until I read his books. They know about that Saturn has rings and Jupiter has moons. How do you know that with the naked eye? Yet, they don't seem to have computers or Hubble telescopes or even the most crude telescopes. So they have a real understanding of astronomy, cosmology. They obviously things that they shouldn't have, being a primitive, isolated tribe.
One of my favorite sections of your book deals with hidden knowledge and hidden societies. We talk about these outfits quite a bit on this program.
Right.
Well, one that we hardly ever talk about is the Rosicrucians, and I'd really like to hear you talk about them for a few minutes, because I remember as a kid, you read comic books, and you'd see these ads from these Rosicrucians in the back, maybe they still run them, I don't know, promising to share their hidden knowledge with you, and I always wondered, then and in years later, who are these guys, and what are they up to?
I actually sent away for their stuff.
Yeah.
When I was younger.
So they still do the ads?
In a magazine. You know, it's funny because what I got was, a bunch of booklets. It's a very metaphysical, very esoteric society that is probably not as secretive as, say, the Freemasons or the Templars or some of these other groups. But their goal is to pass on information that is very esoteric, could be even called a cult in a sense. And you can go to formal Rosicrucian classes and rituals and really become very involved in it, but they also make it very public, which is, for a secret society, is a little bit unusual. But you know, this is a group that started in the 1600s, and it seemed to have come from a person, a legendary alchemist that may not have even existed, so the origins of Rosicrucianism are kind of shaky. His name was Christian Rosenkreuz, and he was apparently an alchemist who literally traveled all over the world and wrote some very important documents that included a lot of secret knowledge and truths, and his goal was to spread that information to the right people while keeping it secret from the political and authority figures at the time, which is why we have hidden societies and secret societies.
How many Rosicrucians are there? How do they survive? Where do they get their money? And do they really have some secret alchemy or alchemy knowledge that turns lead into gold or something like that? You just got the pamphlets. You don't know.
I got all the pamphlets. I never was able to turn lead into gold, but I think there's two different things that we're talking about. We're talking about the more public, like you could go online and Google Rosicrucians, you'll get a website and they'll send you their studies, they'll send you their teachings. I think they might even be free. So they're going to get bombarded now. But but there's also the allegedly more ritualistic, formal Rosicrucian orders. And it's too bad Larry's not on because he's actually a member of one of those orders where you literally go to, they're called conclaves, and you meet with other Rosicrucians and you study and you kind of graduate up the certain levels, like with Masonry, there's different levels and rankings, what have you. So there's like a real serious educational side to Rosicrucianism, but there's also the public, you know, they're very open about handing out that information and getting it out to people. And I read it all, and it's very metaphysical. A lot of it seems like it's very law of attraction oriented. You know, the idea of as above, so below, it's got a lot of hermetic influence. But it's probably one of the milder secret societies that we dealt with in the book. You know, the Masons obviously are the most fascinating. And again, you've got people that say the Masons are satanic and evil, and you've got people that say the Masons are a wonderful philanthropical organization that spreads knowledge from generation to generation.
Well, I'm thinking of also the Templars, which you cover in the book, and a little bit about the Priory of Sion. And
right.
I'm thinking of those guys. They have their own sort of mythology that you track. We've now put a new layer on that. The Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown's books, 200 years from now, his stuff will be, all that will be mixed up, and it will be the mythology, right?
Oh, and Holy Blood, Holy Grail. I remember reading that book and just becoming obsessed with, you know, Ren Le Chateau and the Templars and the royal bloodline of Christ and the Sun Graal, and that's, talk about something going viral. Now, this was long before the internet. Just word of mouth when Holy Blood, Holy Grail came out. And then, you know, much later now with Dan Brown's books, they just exploded and went viral. Whether they're filled with any fact or not, we don't know. It's open to interpretation. But the way that just exploded in popularity, and now, like you said, it added a whole new layer on top of an existing viral mythology, which was the legend of the Templars and the Cathars and the Magdalenian lineage, that Christ had a wife and children and they went to France, and all of this stuff that could be pure legend, but then again, some of it could have been factual. Now we've got novels that are being added to the mix
Yeah, whether it's true or not, I suspect that will be the dominant theme that links all those things together from here on out.
Yeah. And Dan Brown scored.
So we're creating viral myths every day now. We're creating it on CBS television and in soap operas and in comic books this stuff is being produced at such an enormous rate. 100 years from now, I wonder if we look back on this, humans, if we're still here, we look back on this time and think, wow, look at all the stuff we were doing. We were like the Sumerians because we had this explosion, this technological explosion that seems like we're growing exponentially, devices-wise, information technology. It's too fast to keep up with.
And I think it's going to make it difficult for those generations thousands of years from now to really understand who we were and what was important to us, because they've got to wade through the Honey Boo Boo and the Sharknado and, you know, the stuff that was just pure entertainment. And they're going to be looking for scientific knowledge, and they're going to be looking for who were these people as a species at this time? What was really important to them? They have a lot more stuff to wade through and interpret and try to figure out than we do looking back 2, 3, 4, 5, 6,000 years because of technology and because of the explosion of information.
Well,
I don't envy them.
When they try to figure out what our values were looking at Honey Boo Boo and Sharknado, good luck with that, because it doesn't make us look very good.
It doesn't. And that's one of the things Larry and I really got out of this book is like, oh my gosh, everything we do is the viral mythology of the future. What are they going to think of us?
One of the most interesting parts of the book is you explore why some ideas go viral and others don't. I guess you could look at it from Honey Boo Boo standpoint, why that is a hit and some documentary show is not. What are the factors that go into it?
This is kind of fun, too, because as writers, you know, we want to sell books. We want to know, hey, what ideas might we come up with that might be more popular than others? I think anybody who writes or does any kind of, well, actually, anybody who puts information out in any way wants to know what is going to catch on with people. And there are actual reasons why certain things go viral. They could be absolutely ridiculous. One of them is practicality. Does this idea, does this meme, does this symbol, does this whatever make my life better, make it easier? Does it give me practical information? Another one was, does it create a powerful emotion in the person who is viewing it or seeing it or hearing it? And that emotion could be rage, it could be hatred, it could be joy, it could be anything, as long as the emotion is powerful. Humor was a huge one. I think we see that on social networking, especially Facebook's, and I'm guilty of it too, posting pictures that just are so funny, you want to share them with everybody, and then you see them all over everybody else's walls. They just take off like wildfire. So those are some of the key elements that really need, you know, and again, the persuasiveness of the person who is passing the information on is important too. If you're a good salesperson, if you're convincing, if you're persuasive, you could have the crappiest idea in the world, but there's going to be a lot of people that are going to want it because you are good at selling it to them. It could be snake oil, but you're a good snake oil salesman.
I remember from my rhetoric class in grad school, they broke down persuasion into the three types: logos, logic, of course, pathos, emotion. Both of them very powerful, but the most powerful form of persuasion was ethos. That is the credibility of the person involved.
Right.
I think you mentioned that somewhere in the book about in connection with the religious beliefs and Joseph Heinrich.
Right. And also how children learn from their parents because they look to parental transmission of information is one of the most powerful ways that things go viral, believe it or not. And it's a very similar thing as to how religious ideas go viral. If you trust the person, if you have a lot of faith in them, if they are a powerful authority figure in your life, that's going to make a lot more difference than somebody that you've never met, someone with a weak personality. there's a lot of weird neuroscience behind it. I mean, people, sexual things, obviously sex sells. We know that, right? We're not going to lie about that. If it bleeds, it leads, that kind of thing. We get these little phrases that give us a hint to what is important to, maybe not important to us, that might not be the right phrase, but what we pay attention to. And again, what we pay attention to may not really make our lives better, but it does something to us. It either makes us laugh, it turns us on, makes us angry.
Well, the list you have is like the, it sounds like the lesson for why some companies spend $1 million for 30 seconds to advertise in the Super Bowl, you know.
Wait till tomorrow. I think it's a, guys, if you want to see some viral mythology at work, yeah, tomorrow's the time to see it.
You have a section in the book about the science of rumors, and that was intriguing to me because I've got to believe that some of our government agencies use that kind of stuff.
Oh, God, propaganda, and literally, you know, making an art form out of spreading. Yeah, I mean, during the world wars, during the Cold War even, the way that the government and the media were complicit in spreading certain, even if it, you know, it might have been misinformation. In other words, they didn't necessarily spread false information on purpose. But there's a structure to rumors, just like there's a structure to anything else that we send viral, especially when there's fear. And that's why rumors of war and rumors of violence have such a strong effect on people, because they're fear-based. The boogeyman, the bogey, you know, from war rumors of the bogey is coming. And we see that today, too. I mean, I think we see that all the time in arguments between the right and the left and conservatives and liberals, where they're trying to use the spread of rumor, misinformation, disinformation, propaganda to just sort of make their point and have their way.
Of course, you talk a lot in the book about memes, the development of these themes, sort of, and passing on information. And I watch that myself on the internet, how memes spread, in particular in connection with the UFO topic and aliens. And I'm sure your interest, you watch that as well. And I've seen a couple of things that sure look like, if they're not created by the government to study how information travels through the UFO field, they should have been. An example of that, I think, is like Serpo, the story about Serpo, how it pops out of nowhere and spreads all over, and how we sent a dozen astronauts to some faraway planet, Serpo, and we had an exchange. We took some of theirs. And during the middle of that Serpo story, when it came out, some emails were sent out to everyone who received it asking, what do you think about this story?
Oh, funny.
It was like if they were taking a poll in the middle. How believable is it?
Marketing research.
Yeah.
Yeah, I you know, you got to wonder if some of these stories are planted into the media as a way to sort of gauge the collective opinion about something or other, especially with UFO disclosure. Are they ready? Are they not ready? Yeah, I think that happens a lot. The funny thing about memes is that, I mean, this is just how an idea spreads from one person to another. So memes are really not new. They've been around forever. We've always been spreading ideas. But wow, with the technology that we have today, it's gotten so much more sophisticated. So I could tomorrow go on to social networking, drop a meme in. It could be, or I could drop some kind of fake story or rumor. And let me tell you, I have enough connections that it would probably spread pretty quickly. And if it was a really good rumor, a really meaty one that scared a lot of people, it might even go global. And it's kind of, it does kind of make you think, how much of the information that we're looking at is valid? How much of it is, as you said, put there to get a certain opinion or reaction out of us for somebody's marketing research that they're doing, whether it's the government or some big corporation?
I would think that they would have to study it. Things have changed so much that it really does need to be studied to see how information travels, how quickly it travels, how far it can go.
Exactly.
We're talking with Marie Jones, co-author of Viral Mythology. When we come back, we'll open up the phone lines,